Hi, everyone. Earlier this year, a district attorney in Tennessee described Islam as an evil belief system. And hundreds of police officers across the country were found to belong to anti-Muslim Facebook groups. And in New York, a man named Ibrahim can only talk to his teenage son over the phone because of Donald Trump's travel ban. And the situation is bloody too. In March, a man entered two mosques in New Zealand and gunned down more than 50 people. Last month, Craig Hicks pled guilty to executing his three Muslim neighbors. Hate crimes against Muslims are on the rise, and more than half of Americans believe that Islam is a cancer on this country. Islamophobia is worse now than it was after 9/11. Why is this the case? There are two main theories about this. The first theory says we have an Islamophobe as a president, and he is pushing anti-Muslim policies. And yes, Donald Trump is an Islamophobe. He has said that Islam hates us. He has said that he would look into a registry of Muslims and said that he might not have a choice but to close down mosques. But his presidency doesn't explain the rising Islamophobia that predated him. For example, in 2002, 25% of Americans said that Islam encourages violence. That number rose to 50% in 2014, before Trump entered the political stage. The second theory says that Muslims have always been discriminated against in the US, and this is nothing new. But racism against Muslims is not a natural thing. And the level of Islamophobia that we're seeing today is new over the last few decades. Today, I'm going to argue that what we're seeing is a radical change in our country over the last 20 years. And that change can be explained by the expanding war on terror and how it's altered the very fabric of this country. First, I'd like to begin with a story about a town called Bernards Township in New Jersey. Bernards is a beautiful place. It's quiet, it's quaint, it's affluent. In 2000, it had 27,000 people living in it, most of them white. And in 2001, the people of this town elected their first Muslim mayor. The Muslim mayor, his name is Muhammad Ali Chaudhry. He had come from Pakistan, had gotten his PhD in economics, had risen ranks in AT&T. And when he came to Bernards with his family, he immediately became a critical part of the community. He joined the education board. He raised funds for the town's first community center, and he was elected to city council. He was everyone's friend. But 16 years later, when I went and visited Bernards, things were very different. Muhammad was trying to build a mosque for the town's Muslim community, and he was facing fierce opposition. People were pouring into town hall meetings to raise their objections. And at one point, one councilman asked him, "How many Muslims are going to breed here? Because Muslims overbreed." How did one town change so quickly, so dramatically? To understand this, we have to look back at the history of the war on terror under both parties and how it shaped Islamophobia in this country. Many of the policies that we see under Trump today, the family separation, the banning of refugees, even the registry that he proposed, these are all policies that have roots under previous administrations, going back to Bill Clinton. In 1996, Bill Clinton signed the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, which targeted immigrants for suspected material support for terrorist groups. This meant that in courts, the government could use secret evidence against anyone they accused. And Muslim immigrants were deported for nonviolent crimes without even hearing the evidence against them. But this was 1996. So where did this fear of Muslims come from before 9/11? Well, for years, the State of Israel had been promoting a particular discourse of terrorism. Israel was facing a national resistance, and it wanted to delegitimize the Palestinian resistance movement by creating a new type of actor called the terrorist, who was evil and beyond reason. Historically, terrorism was a tactic that was used by states and guerrilla forces. Now, it became an ideology, a person. People committed terrorism because they were terrorists. And so the fight became between terrorism and democracy, between barbarism and civilization. So it just wasn't Israel's problem. Terrorism was the world's common enemy. And the way that Israel pushed forward this narrative was by funding think tanks and institutions and putting on conferences and writing op-eds. So that by the 1990s, the US had largely adopted this narrative that terrorism was a special kind of threat. And by 1996, we had Clinton's anti-terrorism law. So what were Muslims doing around this time? Well, they were building a coalition to fight politicians' pro-Israel stance and fight this anti-terrorism law. In fact, during the 2000 presidential campaign, George W. Bush sought out the Muslim vote. And he said in a debate, "There are other forms of racial profiling that go on in America. Arab Americans are racially profiled in what is called secret evidence. People are stopped and we have to do something about that." That year, in 2000, 70% of Muslim voters supported Bush over Gore in the elections. And then 9/11 happened, and everything changed. Two critical things happened after the attacks. One, the US invaded Afghanistan and Iraq, which I'll get back to in a bit. Two, the US built the infrastructure of a terrorism industrial complex. And I don't have time today to get into all of the ways in which they did this, but I'll share a few examples. The government created and restructured more than 260 agencies, all to focus on terrorism. And from here we have the Department of Homeland Security, the Office of National Intelligence, the national security branches of the DOJ and the FBI. And the budgets of these agencies were inflated by 50%, 80%, 100%, 300%. The US instituted the Patriot Act, which meant that law enforcement could use surveillance on anything they considered terrorist-related activities. And the secret evidence that Bush had criticized during his campaign, well, he used that against Muslims in courts. And some of these Muslims were American citizens. And in some cases, he used secret evidence to sentence them to life. And soon after 9/11, the Bush administration created the National Security Entry-Exit Registry System, a program that required all males over the ages of 16 from select countries to register. And it didn't matter that these people had been living in the US for years. More than 80,000 people registered. Almost all of them were Muslim. And 13,000 were sent to deportation hearings. An immigration rights organization in Queens set up a hotline because there were so many calls coming in from roommates and family members who couldn't find their loved ones. What they didn't know was that their loved ones were being held in detention centers in New Jersey and around the country. A lot of Muslim families ended up leaving voluntarily because they didn't know if they had a place in this country. And a lot of Muslim women protested outside of courthouses in New York because their fathers or their husbands or their sons were deported. This was family separation in 2001, 2002, before Trump. All of these policies and agencies, they were designed for and they acted under the assumption that there was a major threat from Islamic terrorists. But they couldn't prove that threat. In fact, there was no threat. The biggest threat comes from far-right extremists. But so much of US policy and money went into trying to manufacture that threat and then trying to prevent it. And so preventing this threat from Islamic radicals meant going into places that were deemed breeding grounds for radicalization, like mosques or Muslim-frequented restaurants or Muslim and Arab student organizations. Prevention meant that the US poured millions of dollars into a program called Countering Violent Extremism, which was expanded under President Obama, and which sought the public support to find Islamic radicals. Grants were given to law enforcement agencies and to Muslim community organizations to monitor suspicious behavior. And law enforcement had already defined what some of these suspicious behaviors were. In a training manual by the FBI, they stated that suspicious behaviors could include someone who frequents the mosque too often, or someone who's grown a beard. In 2006, more than half of so-called terrorism experts said that the most important important factor that motivated global terrorists was extremist religious beliefs. Not social or political oppression, but religion. And though Bush and Obama didn't say the anti-Muslim rhetoric that we hear from Trump today, the policies under both their administrations were very clear. Being Muslim was considered being a threat. Under the Obama administration, the US embassy in Yemen confiscated US passports of Yemeni Americans for months, sometimes years, leaving them stranded in a conflict zone separated from their families. Last year, when the Supreme Court upheld Trump's travel ban, it justified its decision by citing policies like the registry under the Bush administration and visa restrictions under the Obama administration. The Supreme Court said, "We cannot substitute our own assessment for the executive's predictive judgments on national security matters, all of which are delicate, complex, and involve large elements of prophecy." Over and over again, we've seen that national security has been used as grounds to marginalize and oppress Muslims. Now, all of this was being done despite the fact that there was actually no real threat emanating from the Muslim community. And yet, all the agencies and all the policies acted as if there was a threat. Why were they doing this? The answer is twofold: imperialism and profitability. First, imperialism. After 9/11, the US embarked on its global war on terror. It invaded Afghanistan and Iraq, and it secretly conducted drone strikes in several countries. The US has poured trillions of dollars into its wars, wars that it cannot claim victory over, and wars that it refuses to end. And to justify these wars, and to justify the newly created agencies and their inflated budgets, the U.S. had to create new enemies that it could keep fighting. And the media helped. The media helped amplify the threat from Islamic radicals. Terror attacks by Muslims were covered, got 357% more coverage. 357% more coverage than any other attacks. And even with all of that, it wasn't enough to produce a real sense of threat. And to give you an idea of how it wasn't considered enough, I want to tell you the story about Siraj Mateen. Siraj is a young Muslim man in his early 20s who is mentally disabled. He lived with his Pakistani immigrant parents in a working class neighborhood in Queens. His father had physical ailments and couldn't move much and was largely absent from Siraj's life. Siraj started working at his uncle's Islamic bookshop in Brooklyn. And one day, a man walked in. And this man started talking to Siraj and befriended him. And over the course of several months, this man would give Siraj rides, he would give him advice. He became a father figure to him. And this man would also talk to him about the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq and show him pictures of Abu Ghraib. And one day, this man suggested to Siraj, perhaps they should do something about how the U.S. is treating Muslims abroad. And one day, the man suggested to Siraj that perhaps they should plant a bomb in one of New York's subway stations. Siraj reluctantly agreed with his friend. And a few days after that, the man said, perhaps Siraj should be the one to place the bomb in the subway station. To which Siraj replied, I have to ask my mother first. In court, Siraj got 30 years for conspiring to commit a terrorist attack. The man, his friend, was an FBI informant. And he made $100,000 over 3 years for his services. The U.S. has been literally creating enemies. Since 2001, its stable of informants has grown to 15,000. 15,000 people. They go to mosques, and they go to immigrant communities, and they go to restaurants and businesses to try to lure Muslims into saying something against the U.S. Because the government has decided that the road from religion to radicalization is a short and direct one. Of course, this is not the first time in this country's history that the U.S.'s imperialist aims have been used to oppress groups of people. German Americans during World War I, Japanese Americans during World War II, they were seen as national security threats. They were arrested and detained and sent to internment camps. And politicians used to question their loyalties as they questioned the loyalties of Muslim Americans today. As Bill Clinton said on the DNC stage in 2016, if you're a good Muslim and you care about this country, you can stay here. Well, the type of Muslim they care about are the ones who fight in their wars abroad. The second reason why it has served the U.S. to manufacture this threat from the so-called Islamic radical is because Islamophobia is profitable. Along with the expansion of government agencies, almost 2,000 private companies became involved in counterterrorism or surveillance and intelligence work. Money was poured into contractors and consulting firms and think tanks and university centers. In fact, in the years after 2001, The National Science Foundation gave almost $50 million for research on terrorism. The National Science Foundation. An explicit anti-Muslim sentiment, specifically, has been lucrative as well. Since 2001, foundations and big donors, like the Sackler family, whose names you must have seen on hospital wings or museum wings and who created the opioid epidemic, these donors gave almost $60 million to anti-Muslim groups. Groups like Act for America and the Center for Security Policy and the American Center for Law and Justice. And experts from these groups, they try to explain what drives radical extremist ideology. And somehow they always point the finger at Islam. They warn against the spread of Sharia law and the danger of mosques. On Facebook, people see ads that are created by organizations like these that tout the dangers of Islam. Former law enforcement agents offer their consulting services to identify the threat of radical Islam. In fact, Act for America was at the forefront of the fight against plans to build an Islamic community center in downtown Manhattan in 2010. It became known as the Ground Zero Mosque controversy. The city had already approved the community center, but fierce opposition forced the founders to scrap their original plans. In 2010 was the midterm elections, and this local issue became a national issue, and it actually became a litmus test for which politicians could prove their patriotism, depending on whether they supported it or opposed it. And guess how many politicians supported it? A few years ago, the Center for Security Policy even published a policy paper on how to develop legal-friendly ways to argue against the building of new mosques in your community. And on the streets and in towns like Bernards Township in New Jersey, people started questioning whether they would be safe if their community got a new mosque. What's been driven over the past decade, especially, is that our community isn't failing because of low wages or because of lack of healthcare or lack of education. Our community is failing because there's a real threat in our midst, coming from Muslims. Now, as I mentioned, this anti-Muslim hysteria didn't start with Trump, and it didn't even start in the wake of 9/11. It comes from a narrative that was purposefully built for years. The new category of terrorist, the evil terrorist, that was created to delegitimize the Palestinian resistance. And that narrative has had a lasting effect, not just on Palestinians, but on American families. And to give you a sense of how it's affected American families, I want to share one final story with you. About a man named Ghassan and his wife Majida. Ghassan was the vice president of Infocoms, a company based in Dallas, Texas. The company hosted websites for clients in the Middle East and the US, including Al Jazeera and the Holy Land Foundation. The Holy Land Foundation was a charity that provided aid to Palestinians. And it was actually started by the leaders of Infocom. Ghassan was the chairman of Holy Land Foundation. On September 5th, 2001, 80 counterterrorism officials, including the FBI, the Secret Service, tax inspectors, and immigration officials, they all descended on the Infocom offices. They raided the offices and arrested the leaders. Under the 1996 anti-terrorism law, the government accused Infocom's leaders of sending money to Hamas. Ghassan was sentenced to 65 years in prison. His wife, Majda, she became a single mother, and she had to use her income as a teacher to help pay his legal fees and to raise their 6 children alone. And at one point, the government even dipped into her monthly wages to pay for the ankle bracelet that it required Ghassan to wear before his trial. Today, Majda still struggles to make ends meet. She has to care for her elderly mother. She has to pay for the rent on the apartment that they've been living in for decades. And she has to pay airfare to go visit her husband once a year in a prison in Illinois. And after years of gathering evidence, the government could only show that the Holy Land Foundation provided aid to local charities whose members might have been associated with Hamas. Ghassan is still in jail for 65 years. Rights organizations and lawyers have criticized these material support charges, but nothing has happened. Majda and her children, they've given up trying to appeal to congressmen or judges or the public. I went to go visit Majda last year, and I found an incredibly strong woman, but also a woman who was painfully aware that her family was torn apart. Not just because the man she had fallen in love with 4 decades ago was separated from her forever, but because her children had changed. Her daughter used to be on the streets. She used to be fighting. She used to write articles pleading for her father. Now she won't even talk about the case. But Majda told me something else too. She said it was a political case and the solution has to be political. So what does that mean for the solution to be political? It means that Islamophobia has to be fought not in the courts or in op-ed pages written by Muslim writers. It has to be fought in the streets. It means that we can't fight Islamophobia at home if we're not fighting imperialism abroad. And it means that we need to think of Islamophobia in the larger context of everything else we're fighting for. Why don't we have money to invest in Medicare for All or to erase student debt when we don't even have transparency on the trillions of dollars that have been spent on the terrorism industrial complex, an industry that has torn families and communities apart? Islamophobia isn't just a Muslim issue. It's an issue that Muslims and non-Muslims have an interest fighting against, alongside all those families who've been doing it for decades. Thank you.